so it was very befitting to have the army carry a red emblem. It is now an established historical fact that most of the rebels led by Lenin were Jews. The Times of March 29, 1919, wrote that one of the most interesting features of the Bolshevik movement is the high percentage of non-Russians in the leadership. Of the 30 or so commissioners of leaders that form the central apparatus of the Bolshevik movement, no less than 75% are Jews. Why did the Jews in particular have an interest in Russian or the Russian monarchy? Well, if you don't know about the Khazars, it won't make any sense. Remember that the Khazar Empire had been conquered by the Varanians, later the founders of the Russian monarchy. As you know, the Jews believe in revenge and never forget their defeats. So, they prepared a very careful plan, an invisible plan, to win back their country and have somebody else punished for getting it back for them, that is the Bolsheviks. According to writings of General Leonid Zhvilidov, the French Secret Service had found out that Jacob Sif had directly supplied the Russian revolutionaries with a further $12 million. Zhvilidov also named Felix Swaberg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Sif, Jerome H. Fenner and Max Breitung in the US and Max Swaberg, Olaf Eskberg and Jivtovshai in Europe as further financiers of the Bolshevik Revolution. The ambassador of the Russian Empire to the US, Barkhamtsev, declared that after the Bolshevik victory 600 million rubles in gold were transferred from Russian to the Kunlobe Bank in New York between 1918 and 1922. The book The Seal Train by Michael Pearson shows that, according to documents of the German Foreign Office, up to February 5, 1918 Germany had supplied 40,580,997 marks for propaganda and special requirements. In the same document it is stated that the German Treasury released 15 million marks to Russia one day after Lenin seized power. The bloody massacre of millions of Russians and the enslavement of further millions was, however, of scant interest to the international bankers on their way to world dominance. The war could meet in neutral Switzerland. At the Congress of Vienna in 1815, after Napoleon's defeat, Switzerland was restored. The Confederation was guaranteed neutrality forever by the powers of Europe. An accident? Or, does not such a safe place in the center of Europe fit the plans of the parties living off the war perfectly? As Dr. Coleman proves in his books, the black nobility plays the main role behind the Swiss theater. Now the conspirators faced the question of how to get the rebels and equipment from Switzerland to Russia. The answer was furnished by the Rothschild agent and chief of the German secret police Max Swaberg. He had them all packed in a sealed railway carriage and made sure this passed safely through Germany to the Russian border. When the train stopped in Germany for the first time, two German officers got on to escort it. They had been commandeered by General Erich Ludendorff. Max Swaberg was the brother of Paul Swaberg, the first chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank. In July 1917 the conspiracy supported by the international bankers suffered a first setback and Lenin, another famous Khazar, had to flee with a few others to Finland. But in November 1917 they were finally successful. And no wonder, if we look at the financial support they had following their training in New York. During the bloody civil war that ensued after the Bolshevik Revolution, Lenin was the undisputed leader of political activities, while Trotsky organized the military arm, the Red Army. That name was not an accidental choice. The Bolshevik army under Trotsky was the deadly instrument of the Khazar international bankers controlled by the Rothschilds, equals Red Shield. So it was very befitting to have the army carry a red emblem. It is now an established historical fact that most of the rebels led by Lenin were Jews. The Times of March 29, 1919, wrote that one of the most interesting features of the Bolshevik movement is the high percentage of non-Russians in the leadership. Of the 30 or so commissioners of leaders that form the central apparatus of the Bolshevik movement, no less than 75% are Jews. Why did the Jews in particular have an interest in Russian or the Russian monarchy? Well, if you don't know about the Khazars, it won't make any sense. Remember that the Khazar Empire had been conquered by the Varanians, later the founders of the Russian monarchy. As you know, the Jews believe in revenge and never forget their defeats. So, they prepared a very careful plan, an invisible plan, to win back their country and have somebody else punished for getting it back for them, that is the Bolsheviks. According to writings of General Leonid Zhvilidov, the French Secret Service had found out that Jacob Schiff had directly supplied the Russian revolutionaries with a further $12 million. Nichvilidov also named Felix Swaberg, Otto Kahn, Mortimer Siff, Jerome H. Hanauer and Max Breitung in the US and Max Swaberg, Olaf Eskberg and Jivtovshai in Europe as further financiers of the Bolshevik Revolution. The ambassador of the Russian Empire to the US, Barkhamtsev, declared that after the Bolshevik victory 600 million rubles in gold were transferred from Russian to the Kunloba Bank in New York between 1918 and 1922. The book The Seal Train by Michael Pearson shows that, according to documents of the German Foreign Office, up to February 5, 1918 Germany had supplied 40,580,997 marks for propaganda and special requirements. In the same document it is stated that the German treasury released 15 million marks to Russia one day after Lenin seized power. The bloody massacre of millions of Russians and the enslavement of further millions was, however, of scant interest to the international bankers on their way to world dominance. 89, Chapter 25. The Okhrana, former Russian secret service. The Bolshevik Revolution was, however, not only supported by the US and Germany. The Okhrana, the secret service found by the last Tsar, consisted of several organizations that carried out all the usual functions of a secret service with secret agents, double agents, secret police and agents provocateurs. The Okhrana though was a very subversive and criminal group which greatly simplified the work of the Illuminati. Huge sums of money from the international bankers, among others from Alfred Milner who later took over the secret round table, were poured into the Okhrana that already had infiltrated the Bolshevik movement. Agents steered many of its activities. The infiltration was so strong that in 1908 four of the five members of the Petersburg Committee of the Bolshevik Party were Okhrana agents. They channeled the funds that came from the international bankers to the Bolsheviks, who could therefore suppress their strongest opponents, the Mensheviks and the Socialist Party. Two agents of the Okhrana were the editor and the financial controller of the Pravda and supported its beginning. It is said that the hidden Jew Joseph Stalin, his real name was Josip Vissarionovich Djigashvili, was also a member of the Okhrana since he was an important contact between the Tsarist police and the Bolsheviks. After his deposition of the Tsar in 1917 the Okhrana was officially disbanded, but it was rebuilt under the name Cheka until in 1920 its membership was increased tenfold. In 1921 the name was changed to GPU, then to OGPU, then in 1934 to NKVD. The Russian system of concentration camps that was built under Lenin and reached its peak under Stalin was governed by the NKVD. The camps formed part of the Soviet economy and almost half the gold and chromium production was mined with forced labor by camp inmates. Until 1950 the camps claimed the lives of about 4 million people. In the First World War around 10 million Russian soldiers were killed, not to mention the millions of civilians. Until 1950 the communist system had left about a further 40 million dead. Adding these up you have about as many dead as the old West Germany had living, and those are only the figures officially accessible. Finally the NKVD became the MGB, then the KGB which in 1982 was the biggest secret service in the world, with 90,000 staff officers and 175,000 border guards, and remained it for a further 10 years. The Gosbank, the Russian central bank, functioned after the same principles as the Federal Reserve. It created money from zero and was the dream of every financial capitalist. The Gosbank controlled the Soviet financial transactions even more than the central banks of the West, for all transactions between Soviet companies are carried out by the Gosbank. Thus Gosbank could control all the transactions that involve Soviet companies. Chapter 26 Russian Oil. After the Bolshevik Revolution, Standard Oil, Rockefeller, bought from the Russians 50% of the huge Caucasian oil fields, although it was officially state-owned. In 1927 Standard Oil built its first refinery in Russia, then made a contract with the Russians to sell their oil on the European market and supplied the Bolsheviks with $75 million. Chapter 27 The Balfour Declaration, 90. The establishment of a puppet regime under Lloyd George in London brought a visible change in the official policy towards Zionism. This paid huge dividends when the new Foreign Secretary Arthur Balfour wrote on November 2, 1917, the following letter to Lionel Rothschild, recently made a peer of the realm: Dear Lord Rothschild, I have much pleasure in conveying to you on behalf of His Majesty's government the following declaration of sympathy with Jewish Zionist aspirations, which has been submitted to and approved by the Cabinet. His Majesty's government view with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people, and will use their best endeavors to facilitate the achievement of this object, it being clearly understood that nothing shall be done which may prejudice the civil and religious rights of existing non-Jewish communities in Palestine or the rights and political status enjoyed by Jews in any other country. I should be grateful if you would bring this declaration to the knowledge of the Zionist Federation. Yours sincerely, Arthur James Balfour. The interesting thing is that at the time the letter was written, Palestine was still in the hands of the Turks. Here a nation promises the land that belongs to a second nation to a third. A few weeks later the Turks were defeated and England took control of Egypt and Palestine, France of Lebanon and Syria. Rothschild's part of the deal was to us its influence in the US to involve these in the First World War on the side of the Allies, just at the time when the Allies had a lot of problems with Germany and the Turks. Chapter 28 The Americans want to fight, too. The main base of the Zionists was transferred from Berlin to New York under the guidance of Judge Louis D. Brandeis. Important agents of the Rothschild Bank were Colonel Edward M. House and Bernard Baruch. Take note of these names, they will play important roles. Baruch was instrumental in the successful presidential campaign of Woodrow Wilson. Colonel House was Wilson's closest advisor who selected a cabinet to suit Rothschild interests and who practically ran the whole State Department. It was obviously under the influence of Colonel Edward Mandel House, Wilson became a perfect puppet of the Rothschilds. This he demonstrated very clearly when he did not veto the Federal Reserve Resolution and asked the Congress to agree to go to war against Germany. Because of great public pressure, Congress agreed, too. The public had been manipulated with the same social conditioning techniques developed by the Wellington House of Varea that before had so well functioned in England. The subject of brainwashing machines has been well described in the books of Thomas E. Bearden and in Preston B. Nichols' book The Montauk Project, especially the Montauk Chair, which was based on developments by ITT. 91. This propaganda was also assisted by Colonel House. In 1916 he used his influence, together with the shareholders of the Fed, to convince the American public with propaganda and the aid of President Wilson, the Rothschild puppet, that it was its holy duty to use democracy to make this world safe. Shortly afterwards the Americans went to war. The Illuminati sold Woodrow Wilson to the American people by saying that he represented the new freedom. The First World War was very good business for the Illumined bankers. Bernard Baruch, who became chairman of the War Industries Board, raised his fortune from $1 million to $200 million. The next action by Woodrow Wilson at the behest of Colonel House was to convince Congress of the necessity of forming the League of Nations, which later became the UN. A further decisive step by the Illuminati towards world power had been taken. Des Griffin describes the First World War from the viewpoint of the Illuminati as follows: 1. America's policy of isolationism and neutrality, expounded so eloquently by George Washington in his farewell message and given official expression in the Monroe Doctrine, died. A precedent was established, albeit through monumental deceit, for America's use as a military tool in the hands of the international bankers. 2. Tsarist Russia, a thorn in the side of the money monopolists for many years, had been successfully removed from the world scene. This had been forecast 47 years earlier by top illuminist Albert Pike, in his famous letter to Mazzini. 3. World War I created astronomical national debts in the nations which participated. These debts were held by the international bankers who, as we have seen, organized and stage-managed the show from start to finish. Theaters of war have always proved extremely lucrative to their managers and those who finance them. The Treaty of Versailles, of course, was also based on Rothschild plans. On the American side stood the Rothschild puppet Woodrow Wilson with his advisors and Rothschild agents Colonel House and Bernard Baruch. On the English side, more exactly the side of the Crown, was Lloyd George, member of the Committee of 300, with his advisor Sir Philip Sassoon, a direct descendant of Amschel Rothschild and member of the English Privy Council. France had Prime Minister Clemenceau and George Mandel as a delegation. Mandel, born Jerubam Rothschild, was often called the Disraeli of France, made this round perfect. Colonel House, at the peak of his powers, was the central figure at the peace conference. It happened once that Clemenceau arrived when President Wilson was with House. Wilson was required to leave the room while House and Clemenceau conferred in private. Philip Snowden describes the treaty as follows: "The treaty should satisfy brigands, imperialists and militarists. It is the death blow to those who expected the end of the war to bring peace. It is not a peace treaty, but a declaration of another war. It is the betrayal of democracy and of the fallen in the war. The treaty exposes the true aims of the Allies." Lloyd George said, "We have written a document that guarantees war in 20 years. When you place conditions on a people, Germany, that it cannot possibly keep, you force it either to break the agreement or to war. And we know now who the group of persons behind the Treaty of Versailles was and what their aims were. Some ignorants may continue to deny the validity of the protocols of the Elders of Zion, but the presence of the Rothschild agents at the Versailles Peace Conference cannot be explained away as accidental." 92, Chapter 29. The Rockefeller Ministry of Foreign Relations, CFR. The Illuminati provoked the First World War so that following it they could establish a world government. Had they succeeded already after then, the following wars would no longer have been necessary. After the armistice on November 11, 1918, Woodrow Wilson and his advisor Colonel House came to Europe in the hope to found a world government in the shape of the League of Nations. Wilson's 14 points lost their impact and so their plan failed. That is why in 1919, House met with members of the British secret organization the Round Table. It had become obvious that in order to reach that aim, they had to expand their system substantially. After the RIA had been established in England, it was decided that a fronting organization was also needed in the US, so Colonel House, serving as host for the Round Table group, called, during the peace conference in Paris in 1919, the best heads of Wilson's brain trust together to form a group dealing with international concerns. This group then returned from Paris to New York and in 1921 was named the Council on Foreign Relations, CFR. The CFR has Americans as its members and the Round Table Group as its core organization. Today the CFR, together with the Trilateral Commission, is the most influential background organization in the U.S. Both the CFR and the Round Table are behind the J.P. Morgan and Company Bank, which explains why J.P. Morgan played an important role in its foundation. The innermost circle of the CFR is the Skull and Bones Order. Chapter 30: Preparing the Second World War. On February 6, 1929, Montague Norman, chairman of the Bank of England, came to Washington to consult with the U.S. Secretary of the Treasury Andrew Mellon. Afterwards, the Federal Reserve raised the leading interest rate. On March 9, 1929, Paul Warburg wrote in the Financial Chronicles, "If we allow orgies of unlimited speculation to go too far, then a total collapse is assured." Those who understood quietly withdrew from the stock exchange and invested in gold and silver. Des Griffin adds, "In the fall of 1929, it was time for the international bankers to push the button that set in motion a machinery that resulted in World War II. After they, their agents and friends had sold out of the crest of an artificially inflated stock market boom, the international bankers pulled the rug out from under the whole system and sent the United States into what became known as the Great Depression. In the years that followed, the economies of nations around the world slowed to a virtual standstill. Descent into slavery. The general despair due to the depression was cleverly used by the Illuminati to buy land and companies for peanuts. It also furnished them with a good opportunity to deepen their influence upon the US government, and just as planned, the CFR began to pull important government people, leading industrialists, press managers and high military personnel into their ranks. 93, Chapter 31. Adolf Hitler offers a cure. Adolf Hitler offers a cure, as we have just seen. The German development following the Treaty of Versailles was predetermined by demanding of Germany reparation payments of 123 billion gold mark and 26% per annum of the value of German exports. The collapse of the German currency because of these payments was foreseeable, chronic inflation. In the midst of this chaos, Germany issued a moratorium on all payments of reparation for 2 years. The victorious powers refused and on January 9, 1923 voted 3-1, England voted against at the behest of the city, that the German Reich be deemed in arrears in its payments in kind. Upon the French and Belgian troops occupied the Ruhr area. But when the German workers in the Ruhr called a general strike, the occupation proved a flop. The troops left this dead end when Germany agreed to a compromise known as the Dawes Plan. The Dawes Plan was conceived by J.P. Morgan, the Rothschild henchman, and should grant Germany credits of $800 million in the first 4 years. The Dawes Plan, however, failed when Germany's reparation payments grew. It was replaced by the Young Plan, named after the Morgan agent Owen Young. In order to plunder more easily, the international bankers established the Bank for International Settlement, BIS. Thus, the reparation payments for the First World War were easily executed by transferring funds from the loan accounts of one country to the accounts of another, also with this same bank. Here again the bankers profited, with charges and commissions. Professor Quigley states, "It is noteworthy that this system, Dawes and Young plans, was established by the international bankers and that lending money to Germany was very profitable for those bankers. This is a prime example of the Machiavellian system. On the one hand, the bankers supported all the warring parties and now they even loaned the money for the reparation payments by the Germans. Whatever Germany did, it was clear for the outset from whom they would, or rather had, to lend, borrow, money. It was the very same group that had planned, financed and steered the First World War and had cleaned up in the process. But the show went on. There were other plans and goals to realize. It was the turn of war number two. The immense sums that after 1924 flowed from American capital to Germany under the Dawes and Young plans formed the foundation upon which Hitler built his war machinery. As Dr. Anthony C. Sutton writes in his book Wall Street and the Rise of Hitler, the sum paid before 1940 by American capitalism to Germany in preparation for war can only be called phenomenal. No doubt it was decisive for the military preparation in Germany. There is ample proof suggesting that the influential sector of American business not only knew about the nature of Nazism, but actively, and lucratively, supported it for self-interest wherever possible, in the full knowledge that in the end there would be a war into which both Europe and the US would be drawn. To claim ignorance is incompatible with the facts. The carefully researched evidence that American banking and industrial circles were most instrumental in the rise of Hitler's Third Reich is now publicly accessible. They can be found in the protocols and reports of government hearings that had been published by several Senate and House committees between 1928 and 1946. Among the most important are 94. House Subcommittee to Investigate Nazi Propaganda, 1934, and the report by the Senate Subcommittee on War Mobilization, 1946. A fascinating tale is unveiled by the historian G. Edward Griffin. In the years prior to World War II, there came into existence an international cartel, centered in Germany, that dominated the entire world's chemical and drug industries. It has spread its operations to 93 countries and was a powerful economic and political force on all continents. It was known as IG Farben. IG stands for Interessengemeinschaft, which translates as Association of Interests or simply Cartel. By the beginning of World War II, IG Farben had become the largest industrial corporation in Europe, the largest chemical company in the world, and part of the most gigantic and powerful cartel of all history. In 1926, IG Farben had developed a method to extract petrol from coal and in 1929 entered a licensing agreement with Standard Oil, Rockefeller. This company gave IG Farben 546,000 of ordinary shares values at more than $30 million. 2 years later, IG Farben signed what was known as the Allig Agreement with Alcoa Aluminum. IG Farben produced about half the petrol in Germany. Later they built refineries next to the concentration camps and had the inmates slog for them as forced laborers. IG Farben was one of the largest companies controlled by Rothschild and pumped huge sums of money into the German economy, especially to the future SS. On the board of IG Farben there were Max and Paul Warburg, Federal Reserve, who had large banks in Europe and the US. A further member was C.E. Mitchell, also on the boards of the Fed and the National City Bank, and H.A. Metz of the Bank of Manhattan. Hermann Schmitz, the president of IG Farben, was also on the board of the Deutsche Bank and of the Bank for International Settlement. The brothers of Earl and Roland Harriman, initiated into the Skull and Bones in 1917, greatly helped to finance the Nazis, this via the Union Bank. Subsidiaries of ITT and General Electric supported the pre-war German SS directly. James Martin, head of the Department of Economic Warfare in the Department of Justice, had researched the structure of Nazi industry, and in his book All Honorable Men writes, "The principal link between Hitler and the Wall Street money barons was Jamai Horace Kralischacht, the president of the Reichsbank, whose family for many years were closely aligned to the international financial elite. Schacht was the man who masterminded the plan to rebuild Germany, the Young Plan, and also the Bank for International Settlement. The plan masterminded by Schacht worked perfectly and resulted in bringing events in the Weimar Republic to an explosive head." Dr. Fritz Thyssen, the German industrialist, stated that he turned to the National Socialist Party only after I became convinced that the fight against the Young Plan was unavoidable if complete collapse of Germany was to be prevented. Acceptance of the Young Plan and its financial principles increased unemployment more and more, until about 1 million were unemployed. Fertile ground, of which the Thule Gesellschaft, Thule Society, with its tool Adolf Hitler had all but to make use. After the crash of 1931, German industry was almost bankrupt. Fritz Thyssen officially joined the National Socialist Party and supported Hitler. The largest part of his fortune was handled by the Bank Vorhandel, which in turn was controlled by the Union Bank. The Union Bank was this and the Harriman connection. Of its 8 directors, 4 were Skull and Bones members and 2 were Nazis. Harriman at the same time financed the Soviets and the Nazis via the Brown Brothers, Harriman Bank. One of his closest allies was Prescott Bush, father of George Bush, ex-president of the U.S. Both Prescott and George Bush are members of the Skull and Bones Subcommittee on War Mobilization, 1946. A fascinating tale is unveiled by the historian G. Edward Griffin. In the years prior to World War II, there came into existence an international cartel, centered in Germany, that dominated the entire world's chemical and drug industries.